Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today we take you to the University of Southern Maine's Abramson Community Center for a talk by Lawrence Lessig. Lawrence Lessig is the author of Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and the founder of Root Strikers, an organization dedicated to changing the influence of money in elections. This talk was brought to you by the Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, Maine Initiatives, and the University of Southern Maine Political Science Student Association. Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School and Director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. His talk, entitled Leading, focuses on Maine's unique position in the national dialogue around money in politics and the public financing of elections. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many of our other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is B.J. McAllister.
Hello, everybody. My name is B.J. McAllister. I'm the Program Director for Maine Citizens for Clean Elections. We're a nonpartisan organization that works to defend and strengthen our clean election law here in Maine and other campaign finance reforms. I want to take a second to thank our presenting sponsors, the University of Southern Maine Political Science Student Association and Maine Initiatives. I also want to take a moment to thank MPBN for featuring this important conversation on Speaking in Maine. We are all very excited to see a group of dedicated, passionate people coming out on a Sunday, and I think as an added bonus, you all remember to change your clocks, so pat yourself on the back. I must say, I'm particularly honored to be introducing today's guest because when I first started working in this movement, somebody told me, BJ, you have to pick up Republic Lost. And so, you know, I picked it up and I figured it'd collect dust on my bookshelf, but it didn't. I pawed through each page and I pored over each word, obsessively updating my Facebook and Twitter, hashtag awesome, hashtag Lessig. But in all seriousness, we are really lucky to have today's guest. Our guest is Lawrence Lessig. Lawrence is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School and Director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. Prior to joining the Harvard faculty, Lessig was a professor at Stanford Law School, where he founded the school's Center for Internet and Society and at the University of Chicago. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit of Appeals, and here's the real kicker, he clerked for Judge Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. Lessig serves on the board of the AXA Research Fund and on the advisory boards of the Creative Commons and the Sunlight Foundation. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Association, and has received numerous awards, including the Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, FactCase 50 Award, and being named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries. Lessig holds a BA in economics, a BS in management from the University of Pennsylvania, an MA in philosophy from Cambridge, and a JD from Yale. Ladies and gentlemen, our speaker, Lawrence Lessig.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, BJ, and thank you for the invitation to come and to speak here in one of the most important states to teach the nation about the most important issue this nation must finally come to address. So I'm going to set up this talk, though, with three stories. I'm going to tell you a story about a chip, about a poet, and about a boy. So first, the chip. It's just about 20 years ago when Intel Corporation announced to the world that its Pentium processor had a flaw in it. Deep in the code of the SRT algorithm to calculate the intermediate quotients necessary for iterative floating point divisions, I don't know what that means, but that's what it says, there was a flaw, which meant that there was a certain probability that the result from the calculation would be an error. The probability, one out of every 360 billion calculations, which, as Intel calculated, meant, for example, if you had a spreadsheet, once every 27,000 years, there might be a problem with it, which is about 26,994 years after you can no longer open the spreadsheet because the file format has changed. So Intel didn't think it was much of a problem, but among techies, there was an outrage. Outrage at this flaw, this error, this mistake at the core of the operating system of this chip, and America's techies were not going to stand by quietly in the face of this flaw. So they launched something of a revolution. Thousands marched from across the world. Okay. Not quite. But the point is, there was an incredible uprising among these techies, and they demanded that Intel fix the flaw. And extraordinarily, Intel set aside $475 million, total amount of money spent on campaign finance reform efforts last year, $25 million. But Intel set aside $475 million to cover the cost of the chips that would be necessary to fix this flaw, and millions of people from across the world went to Intel to get their chip replaced in order to fix that flaw. So billions of dollars in total time and value were spent to address a problem which would manifest itself once out of every 360 billion calculations. Okay, that's story one. Here's story two, about a poet. You didn't know you knew this poet, but you do. His name is Martin Niemöller. He was a German pastor and theologian. He lived in Lippstadt, Germany, born in around 1890. But around 1846, he started repeating the following verse, which is familiar to everyone here. He said, "First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me." So Niemöller is describing a certain kind of insight, an insight at the core of intelligence. We could call it cluefulness. It's a certain test. Here's the test. Can you recognize an underlying threat and respond to save yourself or to save your kind? Turns out ants are pretty good at this. Cows, not so much. So the question is, can you see a pattern, and from that pattern have this flash of recognition that you need to do something in response? That's story two. Here's story three, about my friend, a boy named Aaron Swartz. So Aaron was an incredible activist, an incredible human. He spent his whole life working to make things better in the world from his perspective of what better would mean. In the last 2 years of his life, he was hounded by a federal prosecutor who was furious that he had downloaded too many academic articles. And the great fear was he would spread academic knowledge around the world for free, God forbid. But about 7 years before he died, Aaron came to me to ask me a question. And the question was intended to make me more clueful. He was attending a conference in Berlin, the Chaos Computer Conference. And I was spending the year at the American Academy in Berlin, and Aaron came to me, and we spent the afternoon walking and talking and had dinner that night, and he forced me to answer this question. I was at the time finishing a book about copyright, about internet policy, and he said to me, "How are you ever going to make progress on the issues you care about, copyright reform, sensible internet policy? How are you ever going to make any progress on those issues so long as this fundamental corruption defines the way our government doesn't work?" And I was troubled by the question. I was uncomfortable about the question. I pushed back. I said, you know, Aaron, it's not my field. It's not my field. He said, as an academic? I said, yes, as an academic, it's not my field. He said, okay, but as a citizen, is it your field as a citizen? And this was Aaron's style. He never lectured. He never told you what to do. In the style of the greatest teachers, he just asked questions. And those questions forced you to confront. And for me, forced me to confront the fact that it made no sense to do the work I was doing until we solved this more fundamental question first, this question of corruption. Okay, that's the introduction. Here's the argument. It's just over 5 years now since Rick Santelli on CNBC made his famous rant that rallied the birth of the Tea Party in America. And the Tea Party, which then spread across the country, demanding in an incredible way, thousands of people at the beginning, genuinely, thousands of grassroots people organizing and expressing themselves in a powerful and, to the Democrats at least, terrifying way. Now, we don't remember this, but at the birth of the Tea Party, the claim of many in the Tea Party was that the Tea Party was grassroots and nonpartisan. Nonpartisan. But as it grew up, meaning as it got more funding from the top down, this nonpartisanship claim quickly disappeared, as its defining characters were all partisan right-wing Republicans. And Tea Party quickly got spelled as GOP. And the claim that this was a cross-partisan political movement became not credible. And it's soon, just about 2.5 years ago, when a different movement was born, the Occupy Wall Street movement, which also rallied thousands of people from across the country and then around the world for a very different set of purposes, but a rally that defined and characterized the struggle of the day in a very different way from the way the Tea Party characterized it. This movement, too, claimed it was not partisan. After all, if you say you speak for the 99%, it's not clear who's the party on the other side. So this was a nonpartisan movement according to its own self-understanding, and it had a very different relationship to politics. As this article in Time in February of 2012 described, so do these developments signal a shift in Occupy's focus from demonstrations to political engagement? The short answer is no. Politics was beneath the Occupy movement. It's beneath the Occupy movement. Its purpose, its function, its objective was something different, changing the way America thought about a wide range of issues and increasingly defining that struggle in a way that didn't seem very close to the Tea Party. So once again, the claim that it was a cross-partisan political movement became not credible. Now, these are two different populist movements. And despite my job at one of the most elite universities in the world, I consider myself a populist too. But these populist movements quickly became partisan movements. And I think partisan populist movements produce a problem. Because once we're divided, our power is dead. Yet this is the way the people are seen, divided. The Chatterati in America say that the interesting divisions in American politics are between the left side and the right side. But I think we need to get people to recognize the interesting division between in American politics is actually between the inside and the outside. The inside, the politics that happens within that beltway in Washington, and the outside, the politics that happens in the rest of America. And when you listen to what they talk about and see what they do, I think to remix the title from this great book by John Gray, we could say, D.C. is from Mars and we are from Earth. Now, this inside and outside division suggests a certain kind of politics, and the politics of the outside we should think of as exopolitics, to follow the words of Nigel Cameron, exopolitics. But the challenge for exopolitics right now is that it is fundamentally polarized. Like everyone, politicians, political parties, media, even the .orgs designed to bring about the reform of American democracy, the exopoliticians practice this business model of polarization. The more we hate, the more they profit. The more we learn to align against somebody, the easier it is for them to raise money, to sell advertising, to get the unity, to build the movement they want. And the challenge is whether there's a way to frame the struggles we face in a nation to unite groups like this and this. The question is there such a frame? Now, this challenge, I think, is something new. The challenge to build a genuinely cross-partisan political movement. But the opportunity right now is extraordinarily rich. Just last month, Gallup published this incredible poll. If you looked at the issues that divide America and divided Republicans, independents, and Democratic issues, you see the familiar division among the political parties. So if you start with the rich-poor gap, that issue is number 9 for Republicans, number 6 for independents, number 6 for Democrats on the list of the most important issues. Or when you turn to ethics and morals, that's number 6 for Republicans, number 9 for independents, number 7 for Democrats. When you turn to the federal deficit, it's number 4 for Republicans, number 5 for independents, and of course number 9 for Democrats. But the interesting line here is the one I've obscured. If you ask, what is the number one issue, most important issue right now for Republicans, independents, and Democrats, it is the same issue, government. For the first time, as far as we can see, this issue now unites all three divisions in American politics. Government, characterized by Gallup as dissatisfaction with Congress, with politicians, poor leadership, corruption, and abuse of power. And in our own polling, we found a similar recognition of the unity that now exists among Americans. The poll we conducted in December. Do you think current political system works well, or do you think the system is in need of reform? 80% of Americans believe the system must be reformed. Do you believe the system is corrupt or not? 71% believe the system is corrupt. How important is it to you that the influence of money in politics be reduced? 96% of Americans believe it important that the influence of money in politics be reduced. Okay, we're not the 99%, but we're the 96%. The 96%. This is an incredible moment of unity along the dimension of fundamental reform in America. This is who we are, who we are today. We are a people who believes this government has failed. And the question we have to address is how we can build on that incredible opportunity to make reform possible. Now, I think the answer to that starts by understanding clearly what the nature of the problem today is. And I can't help but look at this from the perspective of my scholarship, from the perspective of a law professor. And I look at our tradition. And the fact is, we don't have what our framers called a democracy. We have what our framers called a republic. But by a republic, the framers meant a, quote, representative democracy. And when they cashed out what they meant by a representative democracy, as Federalist 52 put it, they meant a government with a branch that would be, quote, dependent on the people alone. Alone. So here's the model of government. You have the people and you have the government. An exclusive dependency. Now, when you look at that phrase, you might say, well, okay, what does the people mean here? Did the people mean black and white, at least for the framers? Did it mean black and white equally? And of course, the answer to that is no. They didn't care when they were thinking about the people to worry about whether African Americans would have equal role in setting the direction and controlling the politics of our nation. And indeed, what's astonishing in American history is even after a civil war which in the classic bait and switch, Lincoln redefined as being a war about the, quote, proposition of a nation committed to the ideal that, quote, all men are created equal, even after an amendment was adopted in 1870 to guarantee that the right to vote shall not be denied on the basis of race, an amendment which imagined progress looking something like this, but instead a history which saw regress to something that looked more like this, a concerted effort across the South to exclude through literacy tests and various other techniques until Texas perfected an extraordinary device called the all-white primary, which explicitly forbid African Americans from voting in the Democratic primary. All of these techniques designed to keep blacks out. And it's truly astonishing how long it took American law to upend that exclusion. 1927, the Supreme Court strikes down Texas's explicit exclusion of African Americans. Texas went back to the drawing board. 1932, the United States Supreme Court struck it down again, still too explicit. So they went back to the drawing board again. In 1935, the Supreme Court unanimously upheld Texas's latest revision, excluding African Americans from the right to vote. And it wasn't until 1944 that the court finally found a way to recognize what any sane person would have thought the 15th Amendment meant, which is African Americans cannot be excluded from the right to vote. Only then did the all-white primary disappear, and it was, of course, 20 more years until effective equality in the right to vote was finally assured in America. And when you think about that history, there's a certain interesting pattern to keep in mind. It will be important for what I want to talk about a little bit later. The pattern looks something like this. The Old South had basically two elections. There's a general election, and there was a white primary. And in the general election, citizens got to vote. In the white primary, it was whites alone who got to vote. And of course, to win, you had to win in the white primary to be able to run effectively in the general election. Not necessarily. There were people who found a way around, but statistically it was almost impossible. So against that background of history, to answer the question, did the framers mean by the people black and white as well? The answer to that question is obviously no, they didn't mean that. But we today obviously mean that. We today would mean by the people, white and black, both. Okay, well, what about men and women? Did the framers of our Constitution intend to include men and women, originally, both? And the answer to this question is obviously no. It was 50 years after the 15th Amendment, when the Constitution was finally amended to guarantee to women the right to vote. There was no male primary, and then females got to vote. We didn't even have two-stage democracy for women until 1920, finally, when women were expressly given the right to vote. So here again, originally the framers did not mean the people to include men and women both, but now, obviously, it means men and women both. Okay, finally, what about rich and poor? Rich and poor. It's astonishing to me that this bit of our history we forget. We gloss over the ugly fact that our framers didn't much understand sexism and they didn't see racism as an issue to be addressed. We gloss over that, but we forget this fact, that the framers intended the people to include rich and poor both. In Federalist 57, after Madison had described a government dependent on the people alone, he went on to say, "Not the rich more than the poor." The framers were the original anti-aristocrats in the sense that they believed the government had to be structured to guarantee that there wouldn't be a class that could exercise its power over the people. That feature or bug of the British system was to be excluded. Originally, they meant the Constitution to guarantee the rights of the people, both rich and poor. That's what the people, exclusive dependency, meant. They were egalitarians, not speech egalitarians, believing everybody should have an equal right to speak. They were citizen egalitarians, believing all citizens, or those they conceived of as citizens, should have an equal right to participate. That was their view. It is the one view we should celebrate from that past. But the problem with that view is that we've allowed our Congress to develop not an exclusive dependence, but an additional dependence too, a dependence on the funders of campaigns. At the beginning of 2013, a bunch of the freshman congressmen who had just been elected to Congress came to Harvard, and we met with a bunch of them who were interested in the issue of campaign finance reform. And this one freshman from California said to me, "You know, I ran for Congress in my pajamas." And I thought, okay, he's from California. They're a little bit different out there. But what he meant was he never, as he said, "I literally never left my house. I sat in my house the whole time calling people, raising money, which we used to pay for the television ads, which let me win that campaign." And he said, "The depressing fact that I've realized now that I've become a congressman is my job hasn't changed much, but now I don't get to wear my pajamas." Now, what I didn't know at that moment, but which I learned very soon after, is that those freshmen had just received an email from the Democratic Campaign Committee that included a model daily schedule describing how they were supposed to divide their time, ideally, in their time in Congress. And this was the model daily schedule. 4 hours of their 9-hour scheduled day is call time. That's the euphemism for fundraising. 4 hours every day, they're supposed to sit on the telephone calling people. 1 to 2 hours, constituent visits. 2 hours, committee and floor work. 1 hour, strategic outreach. 1 hour, recharge time. I would need about 4 hours recharge time if I had 4 hours of call time, but okay, they're special people, Congress people are. But here it is, an explicit directive that they're supposed to divide their time in this way to raise money. Now, these estimates, or this number, is not far from the estimates of academics who've looked and asked and surveyed. I surveyed a bunch of these studies when I wrote my book, Republic Lost, and found that academics estimate that congressmen and people running for Congress spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time raising money to get back to power or to get their party back into power. And the question we need to think about is, what does it do to them as they spend their time dialing for dollars, calling people they've never met from across the country to raise the money they need to fund their campaigns? B.F. Skinner, a psychologist at Harvard, gave us the image of the Skinner box, a device in which any animal could be trained, or most, it could have been a rat, but I was kind, so I put a pigeon here, to respond to commands and learn which buttons it needs to push to get the sustenance it needs to survive, we need to recognize that this is the picture of the modern American congressperson. As they learn which buttons they need to push to get the sustenance they need for their campaign or to get their party back into power. Now, you don't have to be a Harvard psychologist to recognize that when you do that for 30 to 70% of your day, you develop a sixth sense, a constant awareness about how what you do will affect your ability to raise money, become, in the words of the X-Files, shapeshifters, as they constantly adjust your views in light of what you know will help you to raise money, not on issues 1 to 10, but on issues 11 to 1,000. Leslie Byrne, a Democrat from Virginia, describes that when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, always lean to the green. And to clarify, she went on, he was not an environmentalist. So the first problem is they spend an extraordinary amount of time raising money. But wait, there's more here in this problem. The problem is not just how much time they spend raising money. The problem is also from whom they raise that money. Because they raise that money from the tiniest fraction of the 1%. They're not randomly calling people. They're not just dialing on the telephone or pushing buttons on the telephone. It's a tiny, tiny fraction of America that they're calling. In 2010, 0.26% of America, I know you're thinking as a lawyer doesn't know how to do numbers, but I really mean 0.25% of America gave $200 or more to any congressional candidate. 0.05% gave the maximum amount to any congressional candidate. 0.01%, the 1% of the 1%, gave $10,000 or more to any set of congressional candidates. And my favorite number from the last presidential election, 0.000042%. For the math whizzes out there, you know that's 132 Americans, gave 60% of the super PAC money that was spent in the election cycle we just saw ending. So when you think about this range, 0.26, 0.05, 0.01%, I think at the most, the number of relevant funders is 0.05% of America. 0.05% are the people they're calling, the only people that they're thinking about as they make those calls, because those are the people who are going to give money at the level that matters to earn their call. So what's 0.05%? It's about 150,000 Americans, which the internet tells me is about the same as the number of people named Lester, which is why in my TED talk I referred to America as Lesterland. That's where we live right now. And if the Supreme Court in the McCutcheon case abolishes the aggregate limits on campaign contributions, it'll be no more than 35,000 people who are the relevant funders, which according to the internet is about the number of people who are named Sheldon. So whether it's Lesterland or Sheldon City, the answer is this system is, it's a technical legal term, but bad. Bad for democracy. Because of the role these funders have. These funders produce a dependence in addition to a dependence on the people alone. It is a different and conflicting dependence from a dependence on the people alone, at least so long as the funders are not the people. And if this is unclear, let me try to make it perfectly clear. The funders are not the people. They don't in any sense represent the people. They are a different interest that has a different relationship to the candidates and additional dependence that is a corruption of the design the framers had. Now, by corruption, I don't mean cash secreted in brown paper bags. I don't mean a kind of Rob Blagojevich sense of corruption. I don't mean any illegal acts. I am not one of those people who believe that Congress is filled with criminals or bad people or immoral people. I believe Congress is filled with decent, hardworking, insanely hardworking people in the main. But people who are inside of a system that produces a corruption relative to a design, the framers' design, the design that we would have a government dependent on the people alone. Instead, what we've allowed to evolve is a system that should be familiar after my explication of the history of African-American rights in America, because we have allowed two elections to evolve in America again. One election is a discrete election. It happens twice every election cycle on a particular day. We show up and we vote. The second election is a continuous election. It happens 24/7 between two elections as candidates are constantly trying to get people to give them their franchise in the form of contributions to their campaigns. The one election we should call the voting election. The other election we could call the green primary. In the voting election, all citizens get to vote if you're over 18, in some states if you have an ID. In the green primary, it's the relevant funders of campaigns who get to vote. And, of course, to run in the voting election, you must do extremely well in the green primary. You don't necessarily have to win. There are people who win without winning in the green primary. There is Jerry Brown and a couple other souls like that. But in the main, most candidates believe you must win the green primary if you're to win the general election. So we've recreated two stages in this democracy that should remind us of another part in our history where we had two stages in the democracy. But unlike the Old South, where the white primary was participated in by 85% of the population, in our green primary, it's 0.05% of the population who has the right to participate and to set the agenda that the green primary sets. Now, when you look at the green primary, you can say, well, why is this bad? And it's not hard, especially in a room like this, to recognize why it's bad. If you step back, as Aaron was trying me to do, and look at the wide range of issues any of us care about, whether on the left or the right, and connect the dots. So whether it's healthcare reform on the left, or government bailouts on the right, or global warming legislation on the left, or a complex tax system on the right, or financial reform on the left, or financial reform on the right, we should recognize a pattern here, a pattern which is the constant ability of a tiny, tiny fraction of Americans to block reform. Because in any system where such a tiny number of Americans exercise power in that tiny, tiny election, it only takes a couple thousand to join together to have the effective power to block reform, whether on the left or on the right. And so if we care about certain reform, whether it's global warming legislation or reforming the tax system, the debt, or real healthcare reform, whatever the issue is, you should look at the system and realize we will not get that reform until we fix the system. But it's not just why this is bad. It's also why this is wrong that we should think about the current system. It's not just that it doesn't give us what we want. It's also that this system is a certain indignity, a certain immorality, a certain wrongness to permit this unequal democracy to survive. Because if a democracy is unequal, then it is not a democracy. It is the essential idea in a democracy that the citizens have an equal role, and in this democracy, citizens don't have an equal role. Instead, in this place I've called Lesterland, Lesterland is not a democracy. Okay, now, what could we do about it? If the problem here is members spending tons of time fundraising from a tiny slice of the American public, then the solution, obviously, addressing those two elements to the problem, is to find a way that they could spend less time fundraising, but to fundraise from a wider slice of the American public. That solution that gets them to think about how to model what Maine did. A solution that spreads out the funder influence in a way that this state did, beginning with a campaign that began in 1995. And in 2000, in the first year of the Clean Elections Law, 50% of the Senate, 30% of the House ran with clean elections. In 2002, 77% of the Senate and 55% of the House, and today the numbers bouncing around 80%. That model, finding a way to expand the range of people who were relevant funders, to remove the constant focus of candidates on this tiny, tiny fraction of Lesters, is the model that we have to spread to the rest of the world. It's the same model that has to spread to the country. Now, there are lots of different ways to do it. I'm a strong supporter of John Sarbanes' Government by the People Act that would provide matching funds, it would provide tax credits, it would provide an experiment around vouchers to be given to people to help fund small dollar campaigns. I'm a strong supporter of Represent.us's American Anti-Corruption Act, which would have a large voucher component and very strong rules regulating lobbyists to break the revolving door and make it possible for independence to be restored to the life of a congressperson. Both of these are reforms that, if implemented, would make it such that the funders of campaigns are the people, or more closely the people than anything that we now see. Now, when I bring this idea to people who have not grown up in a system like you have, the first question we get is, well, can we afford it? Can we afford to spend the government's money to help fund political campaigns? My estimate of the provision that I'm supporting is it would cost about $50 per year per voter. So that's our investment. Can we afford that investment? Well, I'm sure many of you have heard of this institute called the Cato Institute. Cato is a libertarian think tank in Washington. They have very strong libertarian views on a wide range of issues, but they've done an extensive analysis for about 15 years on what they call corporate welfare in the federal budget. And by that they mean ways in which the federal government gives explicit benefits to corporations that protect the corporations from the influence of the market or the effect of the market, or subsidies to those corporations. So, you know, one of the most profitable corporation sectors in America today is the oil and gas industry. The United States government, despite them earning more than $100 billion in profit last year, gave them about $5 billion in subsidies. That's an example of the corporate welfare which the Cato Institute is talking about. So if you look at the Cato Institute's estimate of corporate welfare, and you imagine every voter, every average voter, writing a check to crony capitalists every year to cover that subsidy, on average, Cato says, the subsidy per voter is $762.52. Every one of you, I can show you, John Q. Public, right here, every one of you is effectively, on average, writing that check to the crony capitalists to cover the cost of the subsidies and protections which we give those corporations, according to the conservative slash libertarian Cato Institute, $762.52. Now, if we had an alternative way of funding elections that made it possible for us to reduce that by just 10%, then we would pay for the cost of citizen-funded elections, of clean elections, in every year. So this is not an argument that clean elections don't cost anything. They do. But it is an argument that the benefit from that cost is wildly outweighed by whatever that cost would be. So that's what you've recognized in Maine. And the question then is how we get the rest of America to recognize this. And this is where I come back to the title that I wanted to address in this talk. We need to find a way for you to help us lead this debate. We need America to recognize something, that there is a flaw at the core of the chip that runs their government. A flaw that doesn't produce a mistake every once out of 360 billion calculations. A flaw that produces a mistake every single time our government addresses every important issue that you or we care about. We need America to see that flaw. And then we need to get them to see that that flaw produces a certain pattern, a pattern that should signal the need for us to become clueful about the consequence in all the contexts we care about of this flaw. It should get us to be less bovine, more ant-like, as we recognize the consequences of this flaw and as we learn to act. Finally, it should get us to act in a way that for us is hard. This is what Aaron was trying to teach. We need to act though it's not comfortable to bring our friends and fellow citizens into this debate. We need to act even though it's not easy to come out on a Sunday afternoon or to bring others out on a Sunday afternoon to talk about this issue. To act even though it's not our expertise. We are not politicians, and we don't want to be politicians, some of us. I admire deeply those who have the courage to be politicians, but that's not what this movement is at its core about. And even though this is not our field, we need to act in this way, not because this is what we do best, but because this is what citizens must do as citizens. As citizens building this cross-partisan political movement. Now, Maine is an inspiration here, not just because the Cadillac Mountains are the first place that the day begins, and so therefore we could say, let's let this state be the first place that democracy begins as it sweeps across the rest of the country. In this sense, you lead. But because Maine can show how a different system changes how democracy works. The people who are representatives in your state are different from the people who can be representatives in any state where money drives the elections. You've seen that. You've celebrated that. You've benefited from that. And as you have benefited, you need to help us defend the idea that a different way to fund elections is critical to making democracy in America work again. Now, of course, even here, the structure is not yet perfect. There are plenty of examples. Here's one that has just struck me recently. There's this question in America today about whether cell phones are safe. You know, these microwave-emitting devices that we place right next to our brains, are they safe? 70% of us are sure that they must be safe. After all, we have a government that looks into safety, and for 50 years we've had cell phones, and they haven't said anything to us, so it must be the case that cell phones are safe. But if you go on the internet, you'll find all sorts of crazy stuff written. Here's my favorite. Here's a website that says that when you use your cell phone, you have to hold it at least 5/8 of an inch away from your head. Now, how many people do that when you use your cell phone? Okay. One person. Okay, great. You're one of those crazies out there. Now, this crazy quote that I've just shown you, that you should be holding this 5/8 of an inch away from your head when you use it, that comes from this outrageous, radical website called Apple. Because if you read the safety pamphlet that comes with every iPhone, it'll tell you that you're supposed to hold it 5/8 of an inch away from your head because of the radio frequency radiation that the cell phone produces. Now, people who study this are skeptical even of that, because the standards which Apple is using to say that are standards that were built on models that are very different from the people who use cell phones today. The assumption was the person they were testing it on was about 6'4", 240 pounds. But as anyone with children know, it's not 6'4", 240-pound people who hold cell phones right against their heads. So there are lots of questions here about the standards, but this is what Apple says you should be doing. So there are many legislators around the country who recognize that none of their constituents know this. Nobody recognizes this. And so they don't want to ban cell phones. They don't want to say that you can't use cell phones. But what they want to do is to say, cell phone companies need to make people aware of this fact. So here in Maine, there's a bill that's been proposed by Representative Boland. It's called the Wireless Information Act. What it says is that on the packages, you must either tell something about the frequency risk or say that there's information people can read. I know, scandalous, scandalous. To say that a company needs to say that there's information the company itself is providing that you should read about the safety of using the cell phone.